Hello everyone and welcome to the Ecosystemic Futures podcast presented by NASA Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project in collaboration with SocianWorks, a global forum helping organizations and nations navigate ecosystemic transformation. As our world is increasingly digital and interconnected, ecosystemic models are reshaping society, industry, the economy and policy, and they are reframing how we build for resilient futures. Ecosystemic Futures investigates this expansive and hyper-connected paradigm and explores frameworks to help us achieve more beneficial futures. I am Marco Annunziata, your host. I'm the co-founder of Annunziata and Desai Advisors. I'm an economist and former chief economist and head of business innovation strategy at General Electric. Prior to GE, I worked in policy and in finance. My expertise lies at the intersection of global economic and financial trends with technology and innovation. I'm delighted to welcome our host today, who is Dr. Lisa Kale Piasecki. And we were laughing before because actually it comes more natural to me to state the name, the European pronunciation rather than the American pronunciation. So Lisa, I will then ask you to reintroduce myself. But Lisa is an associate professor of management at Heidelberg University in Tiffin, Ohio. She's been involved in higher education for over 20 years. And in addition to teaching, she has many years of administrative experience in higher education, serving as an interim dean, department chair, and director of a center for teaching excellence. She's also active in talent development, which is something which is very close to our interests here at Ecosystemic Futures. She's been serving on the board of directors for 10 years on a local chapter of the Association for Talent Development, including 2 years as president. She's an international educator who has lived and worked in multiple countries, and recently her scholarly work has focused on innovative educational practices, cross-cultural interactions, and workforce trends. She's particularly interested in how technology supports learning and productivity in university classrooms and business settings. In recent years, her research has expanded to explore the implications of the fourth industrial revolution, examining how rapid digitalization and technological advances are reshaping the workforce, specifically with skilled requirements and the very nature of work itself. Over 8 years ago, she has created a special topics course on the fourth industrial revolution, educating students on the foundational principles and exploring the future possibilities and ethical implications. So education and technology, it's pretty clear why I'm delighted to welcome Lisa on our podcast. Lisa, great to have you.
Thank you so much for having me, and great job on the name pronunciation.
You're too kind. Lisa, I've tried to do justice to your impressive bio, but feel free during our conversation to add anything more about your experience. And to get us started, you are teaching in a small liberal arts college in Ohio, which is one of those excellent institutions that often fly under the radar and do not attract much attention. And yet from the conversations you and I have had in the past, I know that the work you and people like you are doing can play an essential role in building a stronger and richer global ecosystem, and not just in education, but also as regards our economic system and the effort to meet some important global challenges. So why don't you start by telling the audience a bit about Heidelberg, what the school's focus is, some of the key curriculum requirements?
Yes, sure. So Heidelberg University was actually founded in 1850. And so we're celebrating our 175th year this year.
Congratulations.
Yes, we'll have a big celebration. We are a private liberal arts school, but we focus on professional preparation as well. We're, as you said, located in Tiffin, Ohio, which is about 1 hour southeast of Toledo, Ohio, and 2 hours away from Cleveland and Columbus, which would be the big cities in Ohio that a lot of people are familiar with. So we have a little over 1,000 students. Our average class size is 17, but we have 30 majors, and our largest is business, followed by education, sports management, nursing, and criminology, psychology. We have, in addition to our 30 majors, we have 32 minors and 10 pre-professional programs, such as pre-med, pre-chiropractic. And we have a signature program, which is called our Plus One Advantage. And so students who stay 4 years for their undergrad if their GPA is at least a 3.5, they can take advantage of the scholarship and achieve an MBA at no cost to them. So that is one of our signature programs, and a lot of students take advantage of that. We have, even though we're small, we have over 80 student organizations. And the beauty of the small school is if students feel that there's not an organization that maybe fits their need or interest, they can start one themselves. And so we provide all those support. Most of our students, about 60%, are student athletes. And so we've got 24 men's, women's co-ed teams, and we compete in the Division III kind of athletic conference. But exciting event for us this year, in addition to the 175th anniversary, is we are opening almost $28 million, a fully donor funded student athletic academic recreation center in the fall. And so that will coincide with some anniversary celebrations. One thing we're frequently recognized for is our school nickname, the Student Princess.
All right.
Yeah. So as far as we have a brand, we call ourselves the Opportunity Makers. So we really value hard work and integrity. So, we'll probably talk a little bit this later during this session on the infusion of ethics into a lot of our courses. So integrity and hard work are part of our values.
Absolutely. So you almost make me want to come back to school. Almost. But any of the people, the younger people in our audience who are looking to choose a college, they should really, really look you up and look Heidelberg University up. Absolutely.
Absolutely.
As I said at the beginning, a big part of your experience is global and multicultural. And you've been running for your students a program jointly with the University in Mexico to expose the students to international collaboration. Can you tell us what triggered the idea, how the program is organized, how it works, why? Why are you doing this?
Yeah, this has been one of my, I guess, most rewarding experiences in teaching. And there's always a lot of them when you're teaching. But so how this all started, I was invited for a teaching position in Querétaro, Mexico. And so in order to do that, I applied for a sabbatical and was awarded that. So I went to Mexico to teach, and through the relationships I built with some of my colleagues there, we were brainstorming on how could we keep our relationship up? What can we do with our students? So we came up with at first a pilot project on collaborating between my students in the United States when I went back and then students in Mexico. And our first attempt at this was to measure if the student experience that we were going to create would increase the student's cultural self-efficacy. So we administered the cultural self-efficacy scale pre-intervention and post-intervention. So what we did the first time, we called it the Amigo Project, is we paired my U.S. students with Mexican students, and through the semester and a series of experiences that they had, we collected reflection papers along the way and then measured the results. So students learned a lot, but initially they were very anxious about this. My students were very anxious about the whole experience.
You know, why?
Well, yes, they were, number one, I think they were worried about the impact on their grades. So,
right.
So everything was aligned with the course objectives, and we kept it kind of low stakes, meaning, these are just going to be a series of reflection papers based on your interaction with what we called the Mexican amigos. And so students had 5 interactions throughout the semester. And for example, the first one was just get to know you. So students were also nervous about, well, I don't speak Spanish. Will my Mexican amigo be able to speak English? And in Mexico, yes, they speak multiple languages. And so they had some anxiety about that. Once they got through that first interaction, just getting to know you, things began to change. And so when we analyzed qualitatively the comments in the reflection papers, the reactions from students became a lot more richer and more detailed. So initially, they were asked, well, what are your perceptions of Mexico? And most of those perceptions focused on, maybe things they saw in the news Or maybe they had traveled to Mexico, but in the resort areas. And so they really never experienced Mexican culture. But it was common to mention Mexican food or Mexican beverages and beaches and culture. And then as we went forward, they really started to develop relationships with their Mexican amigos. And, you know, students talked about how their perception of Mexico changed because they got to know this individual one-on-one in, you know, in a short kind of relationship in a semester-long project. But students actually learned about, in terms of practical business skills, what it means to collaborate with someone who might not be in your same time zone. We had close time zone alignment, but there was an hour difference. Someone who is not a native English speaker, but who can also speak very well. They also learned about differences in technology. At the time, a lot of the US students were using Snapchat. And in Mexico, that wasn't really common. They were using WhatsApp. So students learned about different technology platforms and not to just assume, because this is what we do here, that it would be the same there. So it became very enriching. The second time we did this, we called it the Taco and Hamburger Project, and we had students build commonality on their favorite food. So I know from Mexico's perspective, a lot of students learned about what chicken chunks were and chicken wings. They're like, what, you know, what is that? And so it was a common food that was discussed in American students. And then American students really learned what a true Mexican taco was like. And so it was fun. And then, of course, we analyzed the results, and we have some wonderful quotes. And we did in all of the, I think we had 38 different items we were measuring, all of those showed a positive increase in students' cultural self-efficacy.
It's very, very interesting. It's very enriching from a cultural perspective. But of course, you teach business management. So you're doing this not just to open students' minds from a cultural and personal perspective, but it's also something that can then help them throughout their careers, right?
Absolutely. Because we do know that the ability to collaborate and communicate and work with people who are diverse from you, is very, very important. It's something that's necessary in business. So we also frame this around experiential learning. And we know that if we can bring some of the theory into practice, that that's going to be very, very valuable. One of the quotes from one of the students was, I never would have learned this from a textbook. Thank you so much for giving me this opportunity. And so those kinds of things really make a difference.
It's crucial because, you know, if I look at this from the perspective of an economist, it seems to me we're at a very interesting juncture in global history and global economics, because we've gone through a period where everybody was excited about globalization. Mm-hmm. And now for the last several years, we've gone through a backlash. Protectionism is back in fashion. There is a tendency towards nationalism. There are concerns about immigration. So countries to some extent seem to be closing in on themselves. But at the same time, one, the global economy is globalized to a degree which is largely irreversible. And secondly, reversing globalization would be immensely costly. So there are great advantages in terms of economic efficiency that we get from both having talent from different countries bidding on the same projects and from global trade. So it seems to me that getting people at the individual level, especially starting in college, to be personally more used to working and operating and collaborating with colleagues in other countries can perhaps be one of the most useful ways to move towards a more sustainable global equilibrium. Do you see some of this in the attitude of your students? Do you see this percolating through then potentially how we're organizing our economy?
Yeah, I, you know, some of the students really had hoped that we could like take a student trip to Mexico, and we, you know, we couldn't get that together in a semester long time, but, you know, students expressed an interest on continuing the relationships. And I remember one student in particular who was interested in starting his own business here in the U.S. had collaborated with his Mexican amigo, and they started collaborating. What can we do together between Mexico and the U.S.? And so those kinds of sparks and giving them those ideas that, yeah, this is possible, but what does this look like? I think is really important as an educator. And again, one of the most rewarding things I did, they wanted to continue the project even after the semester was over. And so you don't often see that kind of enthusiasm for a learning experience to continue this experience. So I think it really got students thinking about that. And Mexico, of course, is our neighbor to the south. And so it's very important to the United States. So having those relationships personally developed, I think is important. That's where it can start. And I know when I was living in Mexico and I'd come back to the U.S., I met a lot of Americans and Canadians because we're very close to Detroit and Canada and Windsor going back and forth. And, you know, the operations, they might have a plan, especially from the car industry in Mexico. And so there's all of this cross-cultural collaboration. And I think students were largely unaware of it. I mean, they might have heard mm-hmm. about this, but it really helped bring it to focus because of the personal relationships that they developed, which I think is so important.
Yeah, you stressed a couple of times the importance of personal relationships, which together with a very pragmatic approach to teaching students and building skills is one of the things that I was most impressed by in our first conversations. And related to this, you hold a chair in business administration, and one of the things you do in your courses is discuss the importance of the UN Sustainable Development Goals, which is all very well and good, but you do something which I think is even more important, which is you don't just discuss sustainability as a global challenge. You encourage your students to identify the challenges at the local level and to design solutions at the local level. Can you give us some examples of your experience here and why you think it's so important?
So the course is in our MBA program, and it's Leading Change Through Innovation. And so the element of connecting to the UN Sustainable Goals is part of the innovation discussion. And so students are trained through this course in design thinking. So I lead them in a workshop on the design thinking process, and then they actually also earn a micro credential through IBM's platform Skill Build, which is made free for anyone to do. So they have a foundation first on the design thinking process. And so I introduce the UN's sustainable goals, and they form teams and they go through that process of brainstorming. Okay, which one of these goals is interesting to us? And then how can we make a difference in our community? So a lot of our students are from the Midwest, but not all of them. We have international students. We have students from all over the United States. And so whatever that community looks like, it doesn't have to be here in Ohio. It could be their community back home. And so through a process of design thinking, they have to figure out, well, how can we make a difference here? And so I was looking through the projects that have been done through the years, and it's just very impressive the skills that they develop through the design thinking process, and then ultimately come to some type of solution in the community. So one of the most, I would say, signature programs, because it was coming right out of COVID, was the UN goal of good health and well-being. So I had a team of athletes, and they started interviewing people on campus first, and then they went out into the community on how can we help break the stigma of mental health, particularly with athletes? So athletes also experience mental health issues just like anyone else. And they felt, because they were student athletes themselves, that there was some reluctance to seek out mental health support. So they conducted interviews, they curated sources, and ultimately they came to a solution to build a speaker series on campus that would offer a discussion and resources available to athletes to help diminish that stigma. So again, here's this broad goal of how can we increase health and well-being. They narrowed it down to mental health for athletes and built in these workshops. And so that was a very interesting program because they actually implemented it. Another interesting innovation program was the affordable and clean energy. And students really got involved in checking out how can we bring solar panels to some of our campus buildings. And ultimately, what they found out was sometimes you have the best ideas, but there's some financial constraints. And so I think that's a very important skill because, we all have good ideas, but in business and in an organization, we might not be able to implement them or we have to modify them because of the financial resources we have available. Then another program, because we're very close to Lake Erie, was a marketing campaign that students designed to connect with the Life Below Water goal from the United Nations. And they designed this campaign to discourage the use of plastic straws in the restaurants that surround Lake Erie and on some of the Lake Erie islands. And so, you know, the students are learning a lot of things aside also from how to make a difference in their community. But they're learning about collaborating with others, hearing others' diverse perspectives. They're learning about data collection because they were doing interviews. They're making phone calls, which is sometimes uncomfortable for them. They're also learning about leading change and adaptability and working within financial constraints and analytical thinking, which is one of the top skills. As we know, the World Economic Forum just came out with their Future of Jobs report for 2025. And that is something that employers are seeking in their employees. So it actually covers a lot of things by aligning with the UN goals. And it's, again, a very enjoyable experience to be able to facilitate and just see the ideas that happen. And even if the idea isn't implemented, hopefully when they go out and they become leaders of organizations, they'll understand the importance of thinking about the community as a very important stakeholder and how could they bring about change. And maybe they'll use the design thinking process for that as well.
No, exactly. It's very powerful because there are several important lessons here, right? One is the hands-on experience. So experiencing directly the difficulties of identifying and implementing a solution, the importance of getting different stakeholders to agree, the importance of looking at the financial, economic aspects of it. So it's really tremendously important practical experience as opposed to just theoretically thinking about the problems and ideal solutions. You brought up something in at different points in your discussion now. You talked about the micro-credentials. You mentioned the skills that employers are looking for. And so I want to bring our conversation, Lisa, to the broader topic of education and the impact and use of technology in education. So what do you see in terms of the value of artificial intelligence, for example, as a personalized learning tool? You are a college where there is an enormous amount of attention, personal attention to the student, because you're a small school which prizes personal teacher attention to the students. What is your approach to technology?
So I'll first address Gen AI. Everyone's talking about that. Mm-hmm. It was released, you know, a little over 2 years ago. And I think for faculty right now, in terms of the generative AI, we're at a tough time. We're still, I would say we're optimistic, but cautious. And we're not quite sure, you know, how much should we allow for students to use generative AI for example, for assignments, because we really want to focus on their critical thinking and creativity. But we know that this can be a good tool to enhance creativity and some of the human knowledge. So in terms of Gen AI, I have been using it a little bit in my classroom to first expose students to, okay, what are these tools? Because the current senior in college entered college before something like OpenAI was released. And so they were used to doing things a certain way. Now they have this tool that actually they'll be expected to be able to use most likely in industry, depending on what industry they go into. So right now, I'm kind of starting at some of the foundational levels. So last semester, we spent about 3 weeks looking at the various platforms that are available. And we looked at, well, who owns these platforms? What do they do with your data? What do you have to be careful about if you're going to be using this first academically? Because all professors may have different policies about it. And then what would you have to be concerned about if you're using it in industry? For example, you know, protecting company data. So in some ways, it's foundational. And then we experiment with prompts. So we did an exercise. Say you're invited for an interview at a company. Let's create some prompts to have possible questions that you might be asked. And how would you respond? And so it's going through some of the basics like, okay, so you've gotten now this output from this application, but what makes sense here? Are there some things in here that don't make sense? So you know, evaluating it because it's, you know, only been about 2 years, we're starting to see some students using it, of course, to submit assignments, and it makes no sense what they're submitting. So there's always those things that happen because it's new. But we do focus on the ethics, and we do want our students to be prepared in the workplace. And I know, like for generative AI platforms, employers are kind of expecting that in students coming out of college are going to know something about this, mm-hmm. right? And it's driving the business transformation, digital transformation. So it's very important. But again, it's balancing, okay, we know this, but we also want students to learn and be able to analyze. And how can we use this as a tool and use it ethically? And so students can do both. So there's that end of it. I was using a tool I piloted last semester in one of my classes called PitchVantage, which students record themselves giving a presentation, and through the use of artificial intelligence, they're getting instant feedback on things like their tone, their content, mm-hmm. their facial expressions, and it gives them a score on a scale of 0 to 100. And so students get that score right away, and they could continue to work to improve their score until they're satisfied. And so that's been very fun. Initially, again, students were a little nervous, like, I don't know, because when they're presenting, there's actually a virtual audience of avatars in front of them that's reacting. So the one student was really funny. We were talking about in class, and he said, one of the audience members put their head down and was falling asleep. And well, I knew I had to do something different. So they also thought that the tool PitchVantage was grading them much, much more harshly than I would have in the classroom. So, you know, that's very beneficial to have that type of tool to be able to enhance their presentations and give them such precise feedback instantaneously.
And have you noticed, Lisa, have you noticed the impact? So as they started using this program, this PitchVantage, did you see their in-class presentation actually get better and better?
It did. And so we used it throughout the semester. And one student in particular said that it really helped him get rid of his social anxiety about public speaking. So that is invaluable too, because we know communication skills are so important. And a lot of students, particularly, again, these students coming out of COVID, you know, we're 5 years out, yeah. hadn't maybe had a chance to develop those skills like they would have prior to that. So there's some deficits there. And so this is really helping. And we do have a lot of social anxiety. And, you know, public speaking is always something that creates anxiety in people. But particularly the university, I feel, should be a safe space for students to practice and develop these skills. And so if it can help them in that way, then I think that's really important. You also asked, though, about the adaptive learning. And that's, I think, really AI's great, will be greatly beneficial there. You know, some of the textbook platforms publishers are using AI in that capacity. So for example, students will go in and they're taking a quiz or a test. And if they get a particular answer wrong through the use of AI, it can give them more material to read and then retest them again. The other way we're using it, most universities have what we call an LMS, a learning management system. And so, for example, I had a quiz in my LMS last week. And when I do the quiz analysis to look at those questions that maybe were problematic for the group, I can look at that data because it's built into the LMS. Now, I've been teaching for 21 years. What I used to have to do was manually, I would number each, you know, item, how many students got this wrong. Well, I don't have to do that anymore. Yeah. But faculty have to be trained kind of in this new way of using the analytics that we're collecting and how effective it can be for really personalizing that learning for students and working with the data. And I think that's kind of where we're at, is that there's so much data that we really need the time and the development and training and how to use this effectively to benefit the students.
Yeah, it's in fact a fascinating situation, I thought, because normally when new technologies come out, unsurprised, especially with digital technologies like these ones, like artificial intelligence, younger generations are more naturally conversant in these technologies than older generations are. However, these tools now, and especially Gen AI tools, are both tremendously powerful and very dangerous, it seems to me. If you just think of the classic Gen AI apps like ChatGPT, they're very powerful, but they hallucinate. So if you have to understand when and how you can trust them and how to double check their work efficiently. They also run the risk of, you know, sort of steering or indulging your lazier temptations if you want them to do the work. So it's a situation where teachers have to play almost an oversized role in helping younger generations figure out how to use these tools effectively, which I think is a very interesting challenge for you and your colleagues as teachers, because you really have to understand and master these new technologies.
Absolutely. And that's, I think we're all kind of there, like, well, what should we do? What's the best way to do this? Because ultimately, we want our students to have the knowledge and learn and use it maybe as a tool to enhance but not diminish their critical thinking. And of course, again, as I mentioned, because it is a newer tool, some of the assignments students, you know, we're catching them using it for, they don't even make any sense. So there's this like, okay, you're using this tool, it's generating an output for you, and you're not reading the output to know that this doesn't make sense. That's a problem. And so, you know, I think we really do have an obligation, again, in the university to make sure that students have this grounding in ethics and not violate academic dishonesty, and also to really develop as an individual, to be creative, to have the analytical skills and critical thinking. And so an over-reliance on these type of tools is going to be problematic. And again, we're at this weird point. I think we're all kind of in this state of like, well, what should we do? You know, because it's so new, and we're trying to keep up with using it and the training and the concerns that are out there. Of course, that, you know, we've heard a lot about the bias that can exist in platforms like this. And so how do you actually evaluate that for correctness? So I see these kinds of skills as becoming more important. And as AI becomes more powerful, and, you know, we're seeing this with the music industry and the art industry, in thinking about, is this generated by a human or is this generated by a machine? And what does that mean? Does it matter? You know, it's all very interesting.
You know, there are several interesting issues here, and perhaps that the most basic and trivial is teaching your students to be on guard for AI hallucinations, which are in some cases, like the example you made, is a student getting AI to write an essay and then submitting it without even reading it. Sometimes, even if you do read, the AI can be very insidious. I had an experience recently when I was doing some research on some economic stuff I was interested in, and I was working with one of the Gen AI engines out of curiosity. It provided me a reference to a research paper by the International Monetary Fund, which sounded very relevant to what I was looking at. So this is excellent. It gave me the title, the authors, etc. And I worked at the IMF, so I have familiarity with the names, the titles. So, yeah, sounds great. So I did a Google search to find the article, and I couldn't find it. So I asked the artificial intelligence engineer, I can't find this. Can you give me the link? It provided me a very plausible sounding URL, where I took it and pasted it into a search engine. Didn't exist. So I went back to the engine and said, well, you know, are you sure about this? Yeah, you're right. It seems that the URL I gave you doesn't exist, and neither does the paper. So it can be quite insidious. But the other aspect, which I'm curious to hear your view on, ethical implications. You've mentioned them at several points. And of course, there is the obvious implication that if you are being tested to show some abilities, you shouldn't just give the output that somebody else wrote for you, human or machine. That's an obvious one. But tell us a bit more about how you're thinking through the ethical implications of these technologies as they get through the education and professional system.
Well, I have been teaching a class on the fourth industrial revolution, and we started with the first industrial revolution and went through time and it was another fun class where we read books and we discussed these things. And so when we got to the point of the fourth industrial revolution, which was the majority of the course, we looked at what are considered the common tools being discussed and replicated in this fourth industrial revolution. And we looked at all the ethical implications and what could be what we'd say are the unintended consequences of this technology. So we actually listened to some music and music videos from the 80s also to understand. And one of the ones that I had.
My favorite period.
I know, mine too. So I was able to introduce Gen Zs to some really great music. But we looked at, for example, Video Killed the Radio Star, and what the introduction of video did to radio and how it changed the industry. What jobs were lost, but what jobs were created. And so, what does that mean for society when jobs are lost and jobs are created? What role does government have in making sure that there are jobs available for its society to have a purpose, right? Work gives us a purpose and provides us a way to take care of ourselves and our family. So we also kind of framed it that way. What does this mean for society? And we listened to some songs on robots. And of course, one from a little earlier, Kodachrome, and the change in film. And so we actually had really deep discussions about it, and we explored each element. So we looked at AI, we looked at autonomous vehicles, we looked at robots and automation. And I think what's important, again, at the university level is to expose students to these are some of the ethical issues that experts are talking about. And you need to be informed and then ultimately make your own personal decision on how you feel about this. So I think it's important to expose students on the ethical issues that are being discussed so that they can decide where they fall in the kind of discourse of the technology.
It's an interesting one. So when your students follow the debate on these technologies on the newspapers, traditional media or social media, inevitably they will be pulled between two different extremes. On the one hand, they hear all the excitement and the hype of how all these technologies will make the world a wonderful place where all our problems will be solved. And on the other hand, you have the doom and gloom articles, many of them coming by economists such as myself, saying, oh, you know, these technologies will wipe out all the jobs. So what are you doing in college anyway? Because when you come out, the robots will be doing everything. So I'm curious, how, given that you are giving your students a more serious grounding on all these technologies, how do they look at the technologies? How do they look at the future as they gradually approach their first steps into the work life?
Well, maybe it's because it was just said to me this week, but I had a student just 2 days ago say, I'm very worried that I'll be able to have a job in the future because of all the automation. And so I think that students are aware that there's this rapid digital transformation happening in society, and they're worried. We try to prepare them to be lifelong learners, knowing that the projection is they're going to have multiple careers, and you can't really train for something that's going to change 5 years out. But I think with the liberal arts background, they have connections between how all these various disciplines work, and hopefully there's creativity that's been established there and critical thinking and flexibility to understand, okay, I might not have this job for all of my working life. I might have several different jobs, and these are going to be the important things I need to think about. I need to have a growth mindset. I have to be a lifelong learner. But I do think they're worried. And again, maybe it's just because that comment the other day from the one particular student, they're like, you know, they do still feel that education is very important. I know there's been some conversations on the diminishing enrollments, particularly in the United States, and students not feeling it's as valuable. But I do think once they're in college, they do understand that value of having this education, of being exposed to different ideas and different careers. But I do think there's a little bit of anxiety out there in today's current college student.
And I think in terms of the debate on the value of education, is it's muddled by the fact that we tend to look at averages, right? And in fact, what matters is what do you study and how do you study it? And in this framework, you talked about the importance of preparing students for lifelong learning and for adaptability so that they can learn new skills and as they grow in their careers and be able and ready for different career shifts. As an educator, what do you think is the best way currently to build a base for this? Because, you know, when I look at it from the outside, there are those who emphasize the importance of STEM education and those who say, no, forget STEM because computers will do it all. Students should really concentrate on the classic. They should study ancient Greek and philosophy. What do you think, and how do you and your colleagues at Heidelberg University try to construct or guide the students to build curricula that can best equip them for the future?
Well, yeah, that is really a good question. I think, you know, the benefit of the liberal arts, as I mentioned earlier, really is exposing students to all kinds of areas. So if they take a music class, they might not be a musician, but they'll understand the value of music or going to live performances. And so these enriching experiences are important, I think, in our journey through life. And I think ultimately it's not about how much money you make. It's, are you living a fulfilling life? Are you a good citizen? Are you helping out your community? And so I think, you know, the emphasis more on the creativity, resilience, flexibility, change. I also teach a course on change theory. I think having that kind of grounding is important for the future. So important life skills, because in the workplace now, as we're seeing, even with technology, teaching today is very different than 20 years ago when I started. There's all kinds of new skills we have to have. And so being adaptable to learn these new skills, I think, is going to be really important. And so I think we try to emphasize that it's important to have a rewarding life. So what that looks like for different people is different. And I think that's the best we can do right now in enhancing their critical thinking, analytical skills, just that encouragement to be a lifelong learner and work hard, have a good work ethic. That's important.
Yeah, I think that is a very important part, because whatever path they decide to take, working hard is a big component of success and self-satisfaction. So essentially a mixture of almost like a balanced diet in education, a bit of science, a bit of the humanities, but always studied with seriousness and hard work and the focus on learning and to figuring out what your passion going forward might really be. Lisa, we talked about the importance, the role that technology is playing today, both in society, in the workplace, and in universities. And some of our audience is composed of technologists, innovators, people who are developing these new technologies. So I'm wondering, what would you like to have in terms of technology tools that are not out there that can help you do your job better, can help your students, can maybe help you to keep track of the future path of your students once they graduate? What would you like these technologies to give you?
So that's a great question. And one of the things, as a smaller school, we're working with limited resources compared to, say, a bigger, you know, large R1 research institution. And so I do utilize IBM's SkillBuild platform because they've made a lot of technology training free. And so we're able to integrate that into the classroom because it's very well done. So I would like to be able to have, you know, curate a list of resources that students can be engaged with, we can integrate into the classroom, or they can do outside of the classroom, that don't come with a heavy cost because students are already paying tuition. And so we're always very conscious about how expensive the materials are that we're using to not burden them financially. So from a technology standpoint, I would like to see more collaboration with some of the technology companies, with the smaller institutions that are in the US, because we're serving a lot of students nationally. And so if we could have those types of resources available for us, we would readily use them. And then on the other hand, we need more training for faculty. So a lot of us pursue our own training. And again, we're faculty, so we don't have unlimited budgets for it. So working with educators so that we can help develop the next generation of leaders is really important.
That's an excellent answer. So all the technologies out there, you've heard Lisa. Get working. Lisa, this has been a fantastic conversation. We've covered some of the topics which I think are most important to our future as a society, including the importance of personal relationships and developing a multicultural perspective, the role of technology, its ethical implications, how to build skills for the future workforce. Is there anything that we did not cover but should have, or any last message, any key message you really want the audience to take away from our conversation?
I really just want to thank you for giving a voice to someone from a smaller institution and giving me the opportunity to talk about things that I'm really passionate about, that I really enjoy and find rewarding. I thank you for having me here. It's really a delightful experience.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Dr. Lisa Kale Piasecki of Heidelberg University. It's been a huge pleasure having you with us.
Thank you.
And thanks, everyone, for joining us today. Check out the season's new episodes as we continue to explore the convergence of innovation, technology, and new business models, and how the convergence is reshaping industry and what it means for our ecosystemic futures. Follow us, like us, subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you're getting your podcasts. And you can always learn more or apply to be a guest speaker at shoshinworks.com. Thank you, everybody.